relation to what you were saying earlier, like when you said like somebody's born with a condition, say like a medical condition.
Yeah.
So say you you had done some genetic testing and you found out there was like a huge birth defect.
Yeah.
Karmically, are you meant to have that child, or would it be better not to have that child?
Well, you know, I have to say that that's a personal decision that somebody will make. And they might factor in many things into that decision process. But what we can understand is whatever you choose to do, there'll be a reaction for that. So are there some circumstances that might warrant termination? There may be. But understand, under which plane, under whose sanction will you make that decision? Your own? Some higher thing? When they decide that to enforce the death penalty, if you decide to enforce the death penalty upon someone, yourself, right, for whatever your reasons are, you might be arrested for that. If the state or the military, they decide to enforce the death penalty, someone might be given a medal. Or someone might say they were wrong also and take them to task for improperly doing that. So all these things have to be factored into these things. So when someone takes on such a decision, they should be aware of the potential karmic reactions that come from terminating another life. Does someone have the right, if we want to use the word, to do that? I don't know if they have the right, but you could say, in the world of free will, yes, they can do that. But that doesn't mean that you're exempt from reaction. That will be determined by many other factors. There's an action and reaction for everything, however nobly intended. So my only qualifier here is I say it's individual choice, but people should be informed about what they're doing. Whereas generally people who are quote-unquote pro-choice try to frame things by using a vocabulary that kind of disguises what's being done. Whereas I'd say it's individual choice, but let it be known. Let someone know what they're doing. You're terminating a life. Don't say it's not a life, or it's not a this, or it's not a that. Why not call a spade and say, you're deciding for whatever reason to terminate the existence of another being. Okay? Understand what you're doing. You have the right to do that. But you'll also are not exempt from karmic reactions that may accrue from having taken that action. That, to me, is a more realistic view, informed. Don't try and disguise it away with euphemisms. You know, product of conception, terminating a POC. I think it might be a little bit more than that. And there's gradation everywhere. You know, is there a difference between an egg that was fertilized in the last hour and one that's, you know, in the ninth month of pregnancy? Obviously. There was a time in China, if not now, but, you know, in the recent past, where their stance on abortion and pregnancy, but they said, life begins outside the womb. Up to the ninth month, you know, life begins outside the womb. That's when life begins. That was their official policy. Obviously, this is not going to sit well with many people. So, just that you have people all over the map on this, doesn't that tell you something, really, if you look at it in an unbiased way? How about all of these things are possible? All these points of view, they must be tenable from a particular angle of vision. It's not just a right and wrong sort of thing. That's why I believe that life, existence, is about choice and dealing with its consequences. That, I think, is to be informed. Yes, life is about, why are we here? Free will. We're back to that, you know. If God doesn't interfere with our, he's the one who could compel everyone to obey him. That's not a problem for him. He extends free will to tiny, finite beings. In other words, he gives them, they can choose to embrace divinity and move in that direction or move away from that.
Is free will divine or separate from the divine?
It's a gift. A divine gift. It's intrinsic to our existence. Without free will, we're no different than stone. Free will is what makes us who we are. It's what our identity lies within that, that prospect of choosing, adaptability. We can improve or degrade, love or hate, dedicate or exploit. All this is choice.
Does Krishna have free will?
Yes. And to the degree, to an infinite degree. We have it to a finite degree. His free will is on an infinite level. He's not bound to do anything. But we have heard that he is like anyone. We'll just remember, we're kind of like microcosmic representatives. Like you, all of us are inclined towards those who have affection for us. They may be good, bad, or ugly, but if they like us, we have a tendency to like them. He's like that. Although he's neutral, generally speaking, but if someone has affection for him, he has affection for them. If someone surrenders to him, he surrenders to them. If someone is fully surrendered to him, he's fully surrendered to them. This is the inconceivable power of love and devotion. That the infinite will become fully surrendered to the finite is inconceivable, but that's the prospect of Krishna consciousness.
Is Krishna seen separately from Radharani, or is he part of a unit?
Both. He has his individual identity as the predominating aspect, the supreme male, Radharani, the supreme female, the predominated aspect. She is serving, self-giving, giving to him. Krishna is an enjoyer, a consumer. Together, they make the absolute truth. You can see the conventional religion is lopsided with the predominant male concept of divinity, and the female is like suppressed to the point of oppressed. Where here, she's on equal footing, and not only equal, but in our conception, primary.
Does that change, or is that static?
It's dynamic. So in their dynamic relationship, sometimes she has the upper hand, sometimes him. But her group, naturally, they're also always promoting her. They like to see her in the primary position and Krishna being subordinate to her and bending to her will and desires. But just like lovers in this world, sometimes they're angry at one another for no apparent reason. And that's the play. They have that also. Perceived slight is generating heart, depth of heart. Radharani, sometimes she's so enamored of Krishna. Remember, he's inconceivably beautiful. If 10 million Cupids were to personify as one, that's the kind of seductive charm and beauty Krishna possesses. So she's so wholly given over to Krishna, sometimes she mistakes her shadow for another woman and becomes envious. All kinds of things are possible in that domain. But mainly, her very name, Radha, Aradita, Aradhana, means one who worships by giving themselves. So she wholly gives herself to Krishna in service. And in that exchange, Krishna wholly gives himself to her. He's ecstasy personified. But what she experiences in this transaction, in Krishna's estimation, although he's ecstasy personified, he says, I think what she's experiencing is 10 million times greater than what I experience.
And
he becomes eager to become a giver. And see, what is this dedication all of, where you're giving yourself to someone, the way she is to me? What is it in me that she finds so compelling to go to the extremes of self-sacrifice? So he descends as Mahaprabhu, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Radha Bhava Dyuti Subolitam, Nomi Krishna Srupam. He takes her heart, and once he's in possession of her heart, he's normally of a deep, blackish complexion. It's not a mundane color, just that's a hint. Her heart, golden, it radiates outwards and covers that blackish form, and he becomes Gauranga, golden, the golden lord, the golden avatar. And he is falling on his hands and knees in ecstasy, experiencing what it's like to be her, wholly given over to Krishna. So Krishna, by her association, he becomes converted into a devotee of Krishna. And he's seeing how wonderful Krishna consciousness is. It's all about self-giving, self-sacrifice, and even higher self-forgetfulness. Self-oblivion, if you will, but not to the point of self-extinction. But we're just someone's wholly given over to the other, almost to the point as if no separate identity exists. That's what people seek in loving union anyway. At the height of loving union, where they're so much lost in the other person, they don't know who is who. That's a hint of their level of unification. But together, they constitute the absolute truth. The supreme male aspect, supreme female aspect, together. And everyone else is an extension of them. But we're told we're part of the female aspect, the female potency. Whether in male or female form is irrelevant. We're part of the feminine potency, the giving. And so for us to envision ourselves as exploiters to try and compete with Krishna is silly. He can enjoy billions and trillions of gopis. A man in this world has his hands full with like half a woman. So what is our capacity for enjoyment? But we know Radharani, she has unlimited capacity to interact with Krishna on an equal level. So just like a master chef, right? Say you and I, we have some ingredients. We go down to the sabji market and get some potatoes, some this and that. According to your capacity, you could make something. And I could try and make something. But if there's a master chef, it'll be in our interest to say, hey, let's take these ingredients and give them to the master. We give them to the master, and all it was something raw, say some potatoes. But then the master transforms them in such a way, later, we're tasting some inconceivable nectarine substance. It can't even be described as potato anymore. Now it's just nectar. We're oohing and aahing and feeling nourished, ecstatic, fulfilled, tasting this. And that taste is inspiring a greater hunger to relish more. It's like that. We have some small energy serving capacity. There's one level, by going direct to Krishna, what you then could exact in that exchange. But devotees, wisely, their strategy is, I'm going to serve the substantial devotee of Krishna, which means guru. Guru is Radharani's delegate. So it means really by serving guru, that's her proxy. It goes back to her. And all the gurus, they're passing on to their guru, all the way back to her. She is interacting with Krishna with increased energy supplied by her servitors, extracting, like, she's taking honey, nectarine substance from the center, the central conception of the Absolute Krishna, ecstasy personified, and then distributing that nectarine substance out of remuneration, heartfelt gratitude to her servitors. But because she's able to extract on a superior level, this is a substance that far exceeds our constitutional necessity to taste or relish. So she's saying, here, taste what I'm tasting. Once someone has a taste of that experience, all other tastes are tasteless. They'll be hooked. Okay, I, you know, direct Krishna? No way. I'm giving it all to her. Because what she comes back with is inconceivable. But really, that betrays some kind of false motive. Really, pure devotees are thinking rightly that, hey, she knows how to serve Krishna. Let's push her forward. If there's love involved, love means we're saying, hey, maybe I'm not the best person for the job. We want to make this person happy. Who can do that? We arrange that. You know, why does a mother bring a clown to a birthday party for her daughter? So you think, this person knows how to make her laugh. Maybe I'm not the best person to do that. So they hire someone. And then when the child is sitting there laughing, then the mother's happy. Because you want to see her be happy. And it's a crude example. But someone knows, you know, Krishna, we can imagine, is inconceivable. Like at present, we're 93 million miles away from the sun. It's 150 million kilometers for our European friends. That's where we're rightly situated, right? At that distance, we're thriving. Sometimes we hear science, and I might have the math wrong, but they'll say like, a few degrees, the earth moves a few degrees closer, burns up. A few degrees away, frozen. It's like that precise. Why? Because the sun is infinitely intense in terms of its magnitude of generating heat and light. Even at 93 million miles away, we can't look at it directly. Right? Only in our peripheral vision can we deal with it. So, similarly, how intense is Krishna? But in another way, if you can understand the sun's intensity of heat and light, think of Krishna's intensity paralleled as charm and beauty. Someone who's got that level of magnitude and intensity of beauty, or seductive charm. You can't even look at them directly, and that they're that intensely beautiful that you cannot deal with them directly. At 93 million miles away, you can thrive. So we're, or by constitution, we're out of necessity need to be sheltered by the higher potency. They're, in a sense, made of superior stuff. Like Guru Maharaj gave the example. We used to see in the books in school when you were a kid, they'd always show, like, Detroit, and here they're, or Pittsburgh, and they're, like, making steel. And they'd show some sort of crucible, and in there would be a hot iron ore. And they'd always wonder as a kid, like, how come, you know, some kid would always raise their hand and say, how come the pot doesn't melt? And they say, because it's made out of harder stuff. So they're melting steel in this thing, but it doesn't melt. In a similar way, will be melted by the intensity of Krishna's beauty, charm, and sweetness. That's how beautiful. It's beyond conception. Must be. But his group, his entourage, his servitors, they're made out of harder stuff. They can withstand the intensity of Krishna's beauty and sweetness. Taking shelter of them, we can move forward, shielded by them in a sense.
Does Krishna exist if we don't exist?
Yeah, Krishna exists independently of our existence. Once our Guru Maharaj mentioned, just talking about when you were saying before, like, what's his level, what's ours? He said, although it's not a palatable thing to say, it's mentioned by one of our great gurus, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He says that Krishna's potency is such that although jiva, we're jiva, are eternal, he can do away with the existence of a jiva if he so desires. So he said, that's not a palatable thing to think about, but he can do that if he desires to. Although you were eternal and existed, let's just spell it out, he can delete your file. It's as if you never existed. And, you know, delete it permanently.
But does he need them in the main world for some level of existence?
Yes, that's true. It's for like a playground, a sparring ground, a place where he can go and redeem souls, have the pastimes of redemption. Gurudev was saying the other day, quoting a verse from Bhagavad Gita, Pranip Puritranaya Sadhunam Vinashaya Jadiskritam, it says, Krishna descends repeatedly in this world in his avatars and incarnations to annihilate the miscreants and save the devotees. So Gurudev was sort of joking, but he said, so if the devotees aren't in trouble, then Krishna doesn't have anything to do. Although he's in his own world enjoying, but when the devotees are in trouble here, then he descends in this plane to save them. I'll rescue you, I'll save you. So the material world, besides allowing for the exercise of free will of jiva souls who want to deny him, it also allows for redemption and the pastimes of redemption. So it's like the relative is necessary to contrast and enhance the absolute.
Is there a prediction for another avatar
to
appear?
Oh, yes.
When is that?
Well, the next one, this age, there's four ages. First one's like 1 point, or around 2 million years, 2 point something million years, then 1.8, 1.2, 432,000 years. That's the Kali Yuga that we're in at present. We're 5,000 years into it. And so it's got another 428,000 years to go before the next golden age will begin. And toward the end of this age, when human life is really degenerated, the Kalki avatar will come. Who's in a liberating mode. But now, 500 years ago, the Yuga avatar appeared. Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, as you know, under the influence of the heart and halo of Radharani, comes. And what is he doing? Nadia Gauranga Naga Vara Nichani Janavi. He's wandering around Navadvip, taking his own name. But Krishna is now finding out how much nectar is in one and vibrating his own name. He's in ecstasy. Dancing, it's making him dance. He's so satisfied, it's causing him to dance. And he's liberally distributing this to others through the medium of the Krishna consciousness movement. So this is an extraordinary liberating opportunity for all the fallen souls of this age. It's not that the more fallen we become, that the less merciful is God, or that he has to really, like, dumb down the religious method. But rather, the more fallen we become, the more merciful he becomes. Just like the patient, the more serious their condition, the more potent the dose or the medicine. That's when you get out the heavy stuff. So, the name of Krishna is none different than Krishna. So because the people are so lazy in terms of spiritual inclinations, so much bombarded by the propaganda of exploitation, misled by so many false leaders, the process in this age is simple but profound, and it's based upon ingesting the most potent substance, which is the divine name, Krishna. Like in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, there you're getting the supreme dose and most accessible, easily accessible form. So this is the present-day Krishna consciousness movement, which is more or less accessible everywhere in the world as we speak. And that will last, that opportunity, for some time. But according to what we understand, things will deteriorate. Although this opportunity is there, at the same time, and although society is advancing technologically, one environmentalist framed it this way, he said, this external erosion we see all around us, what is it but the inevitable consequence of inner erosion? It's not disconnected to internal erosion. So we should not be deluded by all the so-called progress that's being made, technologically speaking, while inner erosion is at an all-time high. But the Krishna consciousness movement is a chance, at least on an individual, if not collective level, to reverse that. And under the most degrading circumstances, transcend that, connect with it, and regain one's lost spiritual identity. Muktir hitvanita rupam swarokena virasiti. So we said at the very beginning, this is really the jumping off point. The beginning is to understand you have an eternal spiritual identity in the conscious world. You're a conscious being. But you're in a circumstance where your consciousness is being riveted towards matter, the mundane. That's necessarily a frustrating proposition with limited prospect. But your unlimited prospect lies in that subtle plane which is actually fueling the present circumstance. There you have an identity and a world that's based on dedication, not exploitation, and where you can have an eternal life of love, which is what we're searching for. We're searching for our co-relative. That is the infinite. The co-relative of the finite is the infinite. But we're searching for unlimited, someone with unlimited loving capacity. And when the people, person, places, and things of this world fall short of that ideal, we're disappointed. Or disappointed to the degree that we doubt the possibility of such things. We think, oh, that's for the young and naive. No. There is a co-relative that we seek. The very word Om, Guru Maharaj would remind us, is a big yes. Yes. What you're searching for, that love, ever loving co-relative, your heart's, every atom of your soul's hankering, exists. But where? In the conscious domain, and the dedicating conscious domain, the spiritual domain. And you can connect with that through service. Therefore, you hear devotees always speaking of service and the glories of service. And we learn that just by connecting. That's the power. Sri Krishna Karshini Chasad, to bring Krishna under control. Like the military, the big general, with his finger on the button, he can blow up a country. When he goes home, little baby child comes over and grabs that finger and pulls him around. He's like a play doll being pulled around the house by the affection, the natural love and affection of his child. He's so big, so powerful, so feared, so awesome, but that child can melt the heart of that Pratman, who other people might think is an insensitive, uncaring SOB, right? That child can, with the tug of his little fingers, melt the heart of that man and bring him under control. That's the power of love and devotion as exerting its influence over the infinite. And that's the prospect of the Krishna consciousness movement. Jai Srila Bhakti Samrara Govinda Dev Goswami Maharaj Ki Jai Srila Bhakti Rakak Sridhar Dev Goswami Maharaj Ki Jai Sri Rupa Anuga Guru Varga Ki Jai Sri Chaitanya Sarasvati Mat Ki Jai Sri Chaitanya Sarasvati Krishna Vishwana Sangha Ki Jai Ganga Devi Jamuna Devi Bhakti Devi Tulsi Devi Ki Jai Om Vishnu Pad Vishva Varenya Srila Esi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Sanyasi Vrinda Ki Jai Seva Vrinda Ki Jai Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Nitai Go Premanande Hari Bhava.